2377. John, you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Mr. Chair, Committee Members, House Bill 2377 is introduced by Representative Nelson, who's here today to testify on the bill. And it would require ODOT to spend a yet-to-be-determined amount of money for the purpose of creating a temporary bypass in the Newburgh-Dundee corridor along Highway 99W. It has an emergency clause attached to it, and it has a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay. So. Representative Nelson.
Chair Gilman and members of this distinguished committee, I am Donna Nelson, State Representative from District 24, which is Yamhill County, the home of the Spruce Goose Museum. I thank you for this opportunity today to present testimony in favor of House Bill 2377. For the past 50 plus years, the county of Yamhill has had to live with a massive flaw in the state's transportation system. Located between McMinnville and Newburgh, the two largest cities in the county, is a stretch of Highway 99W, which is a severe bottleneck and centered in Dundee, Oregon. A severe bottleneck for traffic out of the Portland area and also from the coast. For many hours a day, over 30,000 drivers are subject to backed up traffic which spans over 1 mile in length. This delay negatively impacts emergency vehicles, airport travelers, commuters, veterans headed to the VA hospital in Portland, and the economic status of the 11 cities in our county. We are one of the three most rapidly growing cities, but we're fourth from the bottom in revenue generated. Additionally impacted are the visitors to the two top tourist attractions in the state. Well, that's good. Two top tourists, that's hard to say. Those being Evergreen Spruce Goose Museum and the Spirit Mountain Casino, as well as the businesses on the coast. No major employer will launch an industry in this region due to the congestion that would impact shipments for a company. Five major employers have left because of this reason, one being Hewlett-Packard. In the 2001 legislature, the Transportation Committee passed a bill for an interim bypass which my office designed and estimated the cost to be $10 million. What that bill did was to take a county highway in Lafayette, which is located adjacent to Dundee between McMinnville and Newburgh, and tie into another state highway, 240, to be able to bypass this congestion. It gives travelers two options. That measure utilized another county road and state highway and was a reasonable detour for travelers and business. While we seek only $300 million in state and federal funds and a public-private partnership to build the major bypass for the area, we are waiting for the Oregon Department of Transportation to give us the final plan for an acceptable interim relief grid. We had expected to have that plan for you today, but ODOT has been delayed until April. We request the opportunity to return for the final route presentation upon receipt of that plan that was supposed to be ready in January. We estimate the cost to be within $10 to $20 million, a critically needed sum for survival for over 83,000 citizens, other Portland and coastal travelers, tourists, and industry, as the major bypass is some 15 years away, and our county will die without a solution. I thank you for your consideration. And I invite all of you to visit my area around 4 o'clock in an afternoon or about 7 in the morning, and you will enjoy seeing the curbs there in off of 99W for some very long time. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I do have a letter which I would like to just briefly read, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
This is from our County Commissioner, Leslie Lewis. She is one of those spearheading the major bypass. As you all know, she was chair of Ways and Means here in the legislature, and she was my predecessor and serving 3 terms here before she became Yamhill County Commissioner. She says, Dear Representative Nelson, the Yamhill County Commissioners will be unable to attend the public hearing for House Bill 2377 on Monday, March the 28, 2005, because of a conflict. They have their commissioners meeting at the same time with our informal session. Please enter the following comments on the record. The Yamhill County Commissioners are all committed to working with ODOT on a work program designed to find an interim solution to the tremendous traffic bottleneck on Highway 99W between Newburgh and Dundee. Nearly 30,000 cars a day pass through the 2-lane section of Highway 99W in Dundee. At peak hours, the line of traffic stretches over 1 mile for several hours each day. A freight truck passes through historic downtown Newburgh every 10 seconds during the day, harming the economic viability of downtown business as well. We've previously looked for interim solutions with ODOT and elected officials from Newburgh and Dundee. This new work program will begin within the next couple of months. We may not be able to find a workable interim solution, but if we are successful, which we're betting on ODOT, we definitely need help from the legislature and ODOT to fund the interim solution. And House Bill 2377 would provide the needed funding for this interim solution. We support your efforts to help us fund temporary relief for this traffic congestion, which is harming our county's economy, livability, and the safety of pedestrians and the motoring public. Please also note that additional funding for the Newburgh-Dundee Transportation Improvement Project, commonly called the Newburgh-Dundee Bypass, is an 11-mile bypass highway, and that is the real solution to our entire problems. However, it's to be funded by modernization funds from ODOT, federal funds, and possibly a public-private partnership. And ODOT estimates that that bypass is a $310 million project, and beginning in 2010, the ODOT budget, only allocates $25 million, and it's a $310 million program per year, statewide for all modernization projects. I mean, we're in a mess, a real mess. Clearly, this level of funding is woefully inadequate for the Newburgh-Dundee bypass and for any other modernization projects across the state. And she says, we urge the legislature to work toward increasing modernization funding. Thank you very much for your commitment by improving the communities of Yamhill County and for your continued support of the Newburgh-Dundee bypass. Sincerely yours, Leslie Lewis, Yamhill County Commissioner. So thank you very much, and I'll give copies to your administrator.
Yes, Representative.
Not a question, but boy, I can sure relate to that. That was a 1 or 2 tape wait for me when I went to this in my books on tape. And those are long.
That's a good idea. We should have a little roadside stand for books to read.
Drop it off there. But
yes.
And we have we're experiencing the mini version of that in Seaside now with the, you know, during the gridlock, during the weekends and holidays. And it's year-round anymore. And Representative Nelson is so right. My son works in Newburgh. Sherwood lives in Newburgh. And he has found, like a resourceful kid he is, all the back roads. And that's one of the ways he told me how to get through there. So I appreciate your testimony. Thank you.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. I'm sorry I missed the beginning of it.
I am too.
Another committee, but amen to everything I'm sure you said, because this is my district as well, and it's very important. It's strangling the community. Not just with the physical traffic, but the smell and the fumes and the congestion. It's just rattling buildings. Get the big old trucks booming through there, and it's just really, it's hurting. It's hurting us.
You know, Chair Gibbon, I might just add, if we ever had to evacuate you Portland guys and dolls, it would be impossible. And we don't have enough helicopters, haven't been in aviation most of my life, to move you out. I mean, if there was a tragedy, like Mount St. Helens just kept overflowing, and Portland had to get out, or some, huge issue, it would be impossible. Just impossible because of this situation. And it is sad. 50 years. And I don't know what ODOT's doing with $3 billion we gave them in last session, and we gave them $500 million the session before, and I have yet to see where this money's going.
Further questions? Yes, Representative Fong.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, Representative Nelson, your last comment is right on point with where I wanted to go. I think of that money that we did appropriate as part of the OTF3, we're going to have resources that are going to be left over from the fact that ODOT's going to be able to do a much more effective job with the bridge repair and get the same bridges all done for less money. You may have seen that Chair Gilman and I, joined by several of our colleagues, have introduced House Bill 3415, which would say whatever money is left over, whether it's $100 million, $300 million, $500 million, whatever money is left over from that pot of money, will go toward projects of statewide significance, which the Newburgh-Dundee bypass happens to be one, and the Sunrise Corridor just happens to be another, and there's another one down the Southern
Highway.
I mean, the beauty of that list, and I think your testimony really illustrates it, is ODOT and the Commission have already done this comprehensive job of looking statewide at where the priority needs are, especially for freight mobility, but to some degree for passenger mobility as well. They've identified these eight projects, which includes this one, as well as seven others. And I think it's an opportunity. I mean, my bias would be, let's put money into actually getting the big picture built, into getting money toward that $300 million we need to get this built for this project, for the Sunrise Corridor, for others. And so we'd love to have you on as a co-sponsor of that bill.
Thank you.
It's 3415.
I wrote it down.
And Chair Gilman and I
have to go find it.
Have a hearing on it.
Well, we certainly need it. It really is. It's just unbelievable. But thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Representative. Let's see, 2377, Marilyn Reeves.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Marilyn Reeves. I'm here representing Friends of Yamhill County. I want to thank Congressman Nelson. She's our member, Congressman. Our representative. Thank you. I'll get this straight. Did you like that? All right. Well, sorry about that. I got my nomenclature wrong. But I want to thank Representative Nelson for bringing this to your attention. It is an issue that members of our organization have been very concerned about for many years. We've testified. We may not always be in agreement in Yamhill County as to what the ultimate solution is, but that's not different than in any other counties, I don't think, that you see. It became very clear to members of our organization after the gas tax failed. Some of you remember that there was a proposal to add to the transportation budget by passing gas tax. That was certainly touted in Yamhill County as being an opportunity to have more money for an eventual bypass. Unfortunately, the voters defeated that by about 87% in Yamhill County, so whether it was the gas tax or whether it was the bypass or whatever it was, it did not meet with great favor. At that time, we looked at the options, and we truly believed that the congestion in Dundee area, we call it the Dundee bottleneck, had to be addressed, and that certainly there is need for long-range transportation planning, and we have no quarrel with that. But you should not put all of your money into the long-range planning, producing acres of paper almost enough to put on the whole bypass if you put it all out there, I think, and at the same time not have any planning, any design, anything to do the near-term improvements that are vitally needed for everybody who traverses that 99W. Over the past 30 years, in that 99W corridor at Dundee, there have only been three improvements paid for by ODOT. There's a stoplight. Some people claim that was a bad improvement, but, you know, it was listed. There's a center turning lane now, and they repainted the road stripes. They also did a little merging as you come into from Newburgh. But other than that, this corridor, this area in Dundee, has remained basically the same, unlike that which has occurred in Newburgh, in which they have made somewhat improvements to help with the near-term congestion that are there. Now, we believe that there are lower-cost solutions to help in this interim than just to have people sit and stew until such time as there may be $350 million coming from somewhere. Nobody knows exactly where. And so we would urge the legislature to direct ODOT to and to find some funding, please. No use directing them unless there's money. To begin improvements to help to alleviate the congestion in that Dundee bottleneck of Highway 99W. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Marilyn. Questions? Nope, I don't see any. Anyone else to testify on 2377? I'll close the hearing on 2377 and open a hearing on 2502. John?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2502 is also introduced by Representative Nelson, and it would basically require school buses and school activity vehicles to be equipped with seat belts. It has an effective date of December 31st, 2007.
Representative Nelson.
Chair Gilman and members of the Transportation Committee, you've been working very hard this term, and I want to tell you that I admire you and I appreciate every one of you. You know, a few weeks ago, we heard about a murder in Florida, and ultimately it turned out to be a sex abuser who lived within 150 feet of this little girl's home. I immediately began worrying about my community. If we don't learn something from experience, you know, what do we really learn it from? I immediately went to my Yamhill County internet and found that we had 19 sex abusers in my county. And I thought, I know better. I joined the National Alert Registry and found that really there are 155 just in my county. Here's my little point in that story, and this is what relates to what we're going to talk about today. I learned something from that incident and that horrid, horrid murder of that precious little girl by that sex abuser. And I'm doing something about it in my county so that we will have schools who have pictures of all of these sex abusers, these predators, and parents will be able to review them, if they their pictures and addresses, to see if they live in their neighborhood. Well, you are now receiving this story. From the Newburgh Graphic newspaper. And as we were being sworn in on January 10th, this school bus was sliding into a ravine in that city I just talked about, Dundee, with many precious little middle graders, 28 Chehalem Valley Middle School students. At the very same time that we were being sworn into this legislature, the bus driver felt that the cause was bright lights, bright sun. Now, I have to say this was an absolute miracle, an incredible miracle. And thank God for a tree. One tree kept this bus from turning over and over and over again as it headed down this ravine. My question that I'm here to ask is, how many accidents like this do we have to learn from experience, just like the situation in Florida? I don't want the lives of 38 little middle school kids on my conscience because I didn't have the courage to come to this legislature, find out what's right, do what's right, so things turn out right. Also, in front of you, from the National Coalition for School Bus Safety, I'm just going to ask you to just briefly go down, and you can read these stories yourself. November 11th, 2004, school bus death calls attention to seatbelt debate. November 11th, 2004, school bus crash kills 15-year-old girl in Palm Beach County. November the 9th, child struck, killed by school bus. November the 8th, school bus rear-ended, 4 hurt. October 29th, Vienna girl killed when run over by school bus. October 13th, school bus flips over with elementary school children inside. October 9th, cause sought for fatal Arkansas tour bus crash. October 9th, tour bus crash in Arkansas kills at least 15. How many would this have been had that tree not been there? And it goes on and on and on. And then that's just 2004. And then you have the next page back, at the very back, 2003. Over and over and over again. Chair Gilman and committee members, I ask, what is the top priority in our state and our nation? Our safety. What is the top priority in our schools? Our kids and staff safety. Therefore, shouldn't safety be a top priority on the way to school? Our recent bus accident in my district turned out to be a miracle for many families, and you have the news story. I'm asking, will we continue to be as fortunate every time a school bus gets involved in an accident? Of course, you and I hope so. However, is there a probability that we may not be? You have many, many news stories here showing just that probability. Shouldn't we do everything in our power to prevent harm to our school children? Just like preventing those sexual abusers and predators from being near our school, because we learned something from an experience. I learned something from this accident in my district. Now is the time to keep our children safe en route to and from school and activities. We are passing legislation to require commercial vehicles holding 15 passengers to have seatbelts. Sponsored in the Senate. It's coming over. We already require all other vehicles to do so. even specifying what type seats children of various weights and sizes must be in. Why are we indifferent when those children get on a school bus? Is it the dollar sign? Economic development is a great place to start such an enterprise as seat belting buses. We need the jobs. Public-private partnerships, another. Regardless of how our program is financed, we are either committed to safety or we are not. I am. 4 years ago, this bill you have before you was not even allowed to be heard in the Transportation Committee. Would cost too much money. I ask you, what is the cost of one life? Thank you for giving me this opportunity to present this bill. And I think the reason you did it is because you're genuine and you do care. I can answer many, many questions. I have the report card on school bus safety in the United States. I know you all know we have, 550,000 students, and more than half of those, almost three-fifths, take buses in our state. We have over 5,069 of those yellow buses in our state. To appropriately seatbelt those buses, and the new buses, those built since 1977, is only a $1,500 cost. If they're older than 1977, we're just talking about $3,000. Big deal. What's the problem? Here in Oregon, school buses, all types of accidents and incidents. This year, and it includes 05, and of course we're not through yet, we've already had almost 300. 186 of them were the driver's fault. 183 of the buses were from districts. 97 were supplied by contractors of these incidents. 3 by private school and 6 by Head Start ESD. I worked on that one years ago when those kids were being hauled around absolutely like cattle. So that would not occur. Out of these accidents we've just had in this year, in this 2004 and 5, there were 2,440 students on those buses. 69 children injured, 6 drivers injured, 1 pedestrian. This is scary. Go back to last term, last biennium, 03-04, we had 471 incident accidents. 311 of them were the fault of the driver. 285 of those buses, of those 471, were from districts, 173 operated by a contractor, 2 from private school, 9 from Head Start. And just think of this. In those 2 years, we had 478 students on those buses. 41, praise God, only minor injuries, 5 the driver injured, and 5 pedestrians. Now, I'll give you these statistics. I want to tell you, if we go further, we can ask and rationalize all different circumstances. We can talk about, vehicles weighing over 10,000 pounds. Haven't been in aviation for as many years. I can talk that very well. If that's the case, why in an airplane are we wearing seat belts. I believe they weigh over, you know, they have this 10,000 gross weight issue or standard, I guess would be a better way. But I'm just saying, we can rationalize all the reasons on earth that a bus, because of its structure, it's better to compartmentalize the children, keep the seats 24 inches apart like a charter configuration in an airplane so that they can't, you know, get thrown out easily or thrown down the aisle. We can talk about lap belts so that they are not acceptable. We can talk about retrofit kits that we can make acceptable. But then we have school districts that instead of putting two students to a seat, put three and four. We're talking about the standard where if you have a little behind, you know, that's only 11 inches wide, you know, you can set three kids on those seats. So the question is, well, then how would we use these, you know, buses to capacity? Because sometimes, you know, they're bigger kids. We could only put two to a seat. We'd have three seatbelt configurations. My point is where there's a will, there's a way. We can do this. We can afford it. Right now, our bus transportation costs the state over $105 million a year. And a great portion of that, of course, is through vendors rather than districts. We can have all the reasons why we don't do something, but the most important thing, I believe, is doing something, and doing it now. The injuries that these children sustained were from being thrown around in this bus as it went down the ravine. A seatbelt would have held them safe and secure.
Questions? Yes, Representative.
Just a comment. I work as a volunteer in the fire department, and although we have not ever responded to a school bus accident, it's one of our common exercises when we do a mass casualty drill. And although they don't roll the bus over, they say, okay, pretend, you know, when they place the victims, all moulaged and as if they had rolled the bus or felt flipped it over. And exactly what Representative Nelson said, that the injuries are from being thrown around. Mm-hmm. And I guess I have to applaud you for bringing this up again, because we require seat belts to be used in cars. You get tickets if you don't. We require seat belts in planes. And there's not a lot you can do about that when you get that's because they don't want you rocking and rolling around up there when you have turbulence. And we are going to require seat belts in vans and taxis. And I don't know why, if our purpose is to keep our children safe, it seems like it's a no-brainer why that's left out, that piece is left out. Because I can think of a million different reasons why when you slam on the brakes or say something happens on the ice and the bus goes sideways, it's going to roll. And if the kids roll with it, they're falling on each other, they're hitting their heads on things. Unless it's a totally padded school bus, they're still going to get hurt because they'll fall into each other, and they get hurt that way. So thank you.
Other questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Nelson. I think that's excellent testimony. I think, you know, you ask why we wouldn't want to do this, and I agree. It seems it almost does seem like a no-brainer, with the exception of, as you mentioned in your comments, the cost. And my question to you, in the research that you've done or talking with other folks, has the issue of insurance come up? I.e., yes, it costs, I assume it's $1,500 per bus to do this retrofit. How much are we saving in our insurance policies by offering and mandating seatbelts to all the kids? I would imagine we're probably saving quite a bit.
I'm sorry, I don't have that number with me.
Okay.
But I'll certainly look it up for you. I I think we have it. We've done so much research on this.
But you've seen some. I mean, there is a cost. I would imagine
yes.
there has to be a cost
yeah.
benefit for requiring Seville. So maybe that's a good way to make up part of that cost.
Well, I think so. And we talk about the cost per pupil now for transporting them. In our state, this 300,000 kids we transport every day. It's $610 a kid, a student. So, I mean, my gosh, if you even saved, you know, two-fifths of that, you know, $50 a student in insurance would be worthwhile. I think you're going to hear testimony of why not to do this, but, you know, I've gone through it before. All I know is the compartmental concept ain't that good, or we wouldn't have this burden. The burden of fact.
I have one question. In the statistics you gave us, there are several pedestrians that were injured. How would a seatbelt prevent that?
Well, I guess what we're saying is in that accident, I mean, that was an accident.
Yeah.
They just told you what type. It wasn't the bus hitting another vehicle. It was hit a human being. That was mentioned because that was hitting a human being, which, you know, in light of driving, would mean that you'd be swaying and swerving and versus hitting a vehicle. I just felt it was honest to say that.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Nelson, I noticed in one of the handouts you gave us that in Florida, their TAC was focusing on all new school buses. So at least everything prospectively going forward was done. If the cost differential became the only factor, if there was agreement on the policy, would you see that as at least a positive step forward, requiring all new buses, even if we didn't have the resources at this point to go back and retrofit all existing buses? Or is your sense that it's better to do all or nothing?
I'm not sure exactly how to even answer that. I do know that the school buses that are manufactured after 1977 were mandated by the federal government to have additional safety equipment, including closely spaced, highly padded seating, that's the compartmentalization, and a steel cage, you know, around the fuel tank. I don't know. I think the first thing we should do is demand the retirement of any bus 1977 or older. I mean, I think that should be the first step. That's the most dangerous. That's a fire potential. That's a hazard there. So that would be the first one. I wanted to answer your question by what I had to do for nursery school children. I tend to worry about the little tiny ones, you know, and I think of a, you know, adult being able to brace. However, these are middle school kids, so to say, well, let's take those little ones, you know, the three to a seat ones, and what buses are going to be used, dedicate buses to sizes, if we could. Of course, there's many sizes of kids. I guess that's what I would say first versus, you know, all the new ones. I'd say let's do a portion and do those where the greatest risk is.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Deborah Lincoln.
Chair Gill, members of the committee, I want to thank you for hearing us today. We, for the record, my name is Deborah Lincoln. I'm with the Department of Education, and I'm the Director of Pupil Transportation. I've been in that position since 1977, and I've been in pupil transportation since 1973. And I have with me today Craig Pruitt, who's also with the Department of Education, and Stephen Hewlett with the Department of Ed. We're here today to oppose House Bill 2502. And however, I would like to just echo some of the things that Representative Nelson said. Our primary concern is safety of children. And we always have wanted to spend more money to give kids a safer ride to school. And Our experience has been that for years, experts have been studying this very issue, and that includes engineers from, for example, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. I'm going to give you a little bit more illustration about that. But we, again, can't put a price on a life. And so we would like to spend more dollars, and I'll give you some examples of places where you can spend more dollars to protect kids and give them even a safer ride. I think a picture is worth a thousand words. I have some information I'd like to present to you about the safest ride on a school bus. Nationwide, there's about 450,000 school buses in the United States, and we transport 25 million students to and from school. And they travel 4 billion miles, and we average 5 fatalities inside the school bus per year. There are fatalities outside because they're either hit by oncoming motorists or run over by the bus themselves. But I think the issue today we're discussing is seatbelts, and so the only thing that would affect that would be fatalities inside the bus. So we have an average that they've been studying statistics about 5 inside the school bus. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says that school buses are the safest form of ground transportation. I'm very proud of that record. Oregon has an incredible safety record also. There have been 3 fatalities since Oregon has been keeping records on school bus statistics. Those happened to all 3 be in the 1976 Lafayette train bus crash. I agree with Representative Nelson. 0 is the only acceptable amount. And we think that the key components are safe, well-trained drivers and safe equipment. The school bus today probably looks a little bit different from what you rode to school on. And Representative Nelson mentioned a pre-77. Today, school buses are regulated by National Highway Traffic Safety Administration with a series of Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards, or FMVSs. And I just put the CFR there if you want to look that up. It's a great big thick book and studied by engineers in engineering terms. So you'll just have to take my word here. There's 36 Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards that apply to school bus. 4 are unique to school buses. No other vehicle has these 4 particular FMVSs. 1 is pedestrian safety devices. That's your school bus safety lights that flash on the top of the bus. It also could include the stop sign. It also has school bus rollover protection. The joints have to be attached or secured together so that in the event of a rollover, the roof doesn't crash. In fact, the bus has to be able to hold 1.5 times its own weight before the roof actually starts to compress or come apart. And again, the joints can't come apart. There's certain engineering terms of exactly what kind of force before the body comes apart. If you think about some of the very serious train bus crashes and some of the bus crashes that we've had, you may remember Fox River Grove that was about 10 years ago. In that crash, the body and the chassis separated, but the body still did not come apart. Again, the joint hold together. The last one that I want to mention is the school bus passenger seating and crash protection. And I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about what that is. And Representative Nelson referred to that as compartmentalization. And that spells out in detail, engineering terms, how those seat frames are going to be attached to the flooring, how the cushions are going to be attached to the frame, and the amount of give that a seat has to have. And I'm going to show you an illustration of that. This is just kind of a blow-up, I know you can't read it, of all the different Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards that apply to school buses. This is a highly regulated vehicle. So, the big question, why aren't there seatbelts? Well, NHTSA just completed a study. It was about in 1999, 2000. They spent a couple million dollars on it when they went back and they tested again through some crash testing to find out why shouldn't we use seatbelts. They said lead belts are not safe. That was the conclusion of this study, and I'll be happy to provide you a copy of that study. I have it back at the office. They also said that compartmentalization works great. Lap shoulder belts perform best. And I think when we talk about seat belts, we need to be sure that we distinguish between lap belts and lap shoulder belts. They felt that nationally, lap shoulder belts could save one child per year. And again, the annual cost would be $100 million for the whole United States. I still feel that there's no price that you could put on a student's life. But the fear here is that when students wear lap shoulder belts, that they'll take the lap belt off of their shoulder and put it underneath their arm, and now what you have is a lap belt. And that's where the injuries are at. This is an excerpt from their tests. They took a frontal barrier crash test, and this is a new school bus that they crash at 40 miles an hour into a barrier. And you can see down at the wheels how the body starts to separate from the chassis. This is how the bus is made. The chassis is made first, and then the body is made, and they put the body on the chassis. So here is a bus crashing at 40 miles an hour. You're going to see it from various angles. Pretty violent. On this next view, take a look at the rear tires, and again, you'll see how the body is separating from the chassis. Once they get this data, they also did a side impact. Let me show you this here, too. Again, a truck at about 40 miles an hour, T-bone a bus. Please look at the roof again. The roof doesn't separate. The body, while it's penetrated by the truck, it still hasn't come apart. So this is pretty violent. It's going to show you from the inside, too, what it looked like as the truck penetrates the body. And again, you'll see the integrity of the body inside the bus. The roof isn't separating. The seats in the back stay pretty much intact. I'm not saying that this wouldn't be a dangerous accident. This would. But the question is, what's the best way to protect the occupants? Unfortunately, people sitting in the impact zone, belted or not, are probably in a very severe location, not likely to come out without any kind of injuries. Once they get this data, now they can do a sled test, and they can evaluate many different kinds of restraints. And so they looked at compartmentalization, lap belts, lap shoulder belts, increasing the height of seats, and then they also looked at some other systems like R-bars, like you would have in roller coasters, the bars that come down. So I'm just going to show you a couple of things that pertains to this bill. They also had to evaluate different sizes of children, because the school bus today transports 6-year-olds, high school students, and so that's why they use all these different sizes. So this is compartmentalization, and you'll notice the knees impact first, followed by the head and chest. The seat coils forward, comes back, allows them to fall on the floor. That's how compartmentalization is designed to function. This looks like pretty violent. However, this is survivable. They measure the head trauma, they measure the neck trauma, and they say that this is a survivable accident. Not that they're not going to be hurt, not that they're not going to be sore, but it's not life-threatening. This is with lap belts, and you need to look at what happens to the head. this is not survivable. The amount that they measure, the impact to the head and the trauma to the neck is not survivable. People would not live through this. And here's another. This is the 50th percentile male with a lap belt. Again, very graphic. You'll see what's happening to his head there. These are very serious accidents with major damage. This is with a lap shoulder belt. Again, lap shoulder belt performed pretty well. They felt that this was survivable. Even though there's a lot of strain to the neck, they felt that this is survivable, but their real fear is the kids won't wear them properly, that they'll take them off and they'll essentially make them a lap belt. And we've already seen what lap belts do. So does Oregon want lap belts or lap shoulder belts on buses? NHTSA concluded when they finished this study that they were going to develop engineering standards for how they would install lap shoulder belts on school buses. They have not proposed that language yet. I have been told by one of the engineers there that it would be soon, for a couple of years. But he told me again it would be by the end of this year. You do need to know that it will reduce capacity. It will require more school buses. There will be a significant cost. I've done some projection on this particular bill, and I come up with belts at $3,792,000 for all seat belts, and that was figuring $20 per belt per seating position. The problem is, if you don't have a seatbelt ready frame, a frame that's ready to handle the belt, then the current frames have to be replaced. For buses such as a Carpenter, which is a brand, is no longer produced new in this country, and so therefore there are no new Carpenter frames. And it's going to be very difficult to find a manufacturer who would be willing to put their frames in a Carpenter bus. So that is one problem right there. But we'll just say we get past all those problems. I had no way to do this, but I said half of the frames in the buses that we have in Oregon would need to be replaced. I thought that was a fair number. At $100 a piece per the manufacturers, that's another $3,160,000. The installation will require the removal of the old seat, which takes two people, one on top, one on underneath the bus, to get the bolts loose. You need to take the seat frame out. If you had any kind of luggage compartment or store or fuel tank, the fuel tank has to be removed. The storage luggage storage has to be removed. Any undercoating has to be removed. Then you can remove the seat frame, and then you have to take the cushions off and then put the new frame in, install the belts, put the upholstery back on, hopefully it would fit, and then install it back in the bus. I used a modest figure of $100 for labor, again, for each of the half of the seats that I thought needed to be replaced. Then, if you're going to require a school bus driver or Oregon school children to be buckled up in buses, somebody's going to have to monitor that those seat belts are placed on the students correctly, that it's worn low across the lap, across the pelvis, and if it's a lap belt, that the lap belt remains over the shoulder belt remains over the shoulder. You're going to have an assistant on the bus, because a bus driver cannot do that while they're also driving the bus. And that's a projected, even at minimum wage, at $30 million. And that expense will continue per biennium. Like I mentioned, older buses can't be retrofitted. I will agree that lap shoulder belts may make a safer ride. If it's used correctly, it will reduce the capacity. It's going to increase the number of buses that we need across the state. It's going to increase the number of drivers that we need across the state. It's going to increase the number of the fuel we use, increase the storage needs, and more technicians. I think there's better ways for us to spend our dollars. I think you should look at the current safety record And you're going to find that there's other ways to improve student transportation, and you'll get more for your money if you want to improve, if you truly want to improve safety. And one of the things is we need to continue what we're doing, and that's transporting. We think that a key component of that is well-trained drivers, and the statute requires us to write rules for the training, which we have done. The department trains instructors, drivers. We test for the DMV. We have an agreement. Each school bus driver has to meet certain training requirements. They have to have a certain driving record, which we monitor very carefully, a criminal record that's acceptable, and they also have physical standards that they also must pass. So it's a very rigorous to become a school bus driver. We think another safety component is the equipment. We have standards for equipment, what constitutes a safe equipment. We go out and we inspect buses. We take them out of service if they don't meet our requirement. And also districts have a requirement to inspect their buses annually, and they send that information into us. It's true that we have 400 to 500 accidents per year. The criteria for a school bus accident is not the same as a DMV accident. You'll notice that the threshold is only $750 to the bus and any damage to any other vehicle. So that's even backing into a little post. I would like to give you an example. And if I can just back up a minute here for some of the statistics that Representative Nelson got from our office. It is true that we have about 400 to 500 accidents per year. Again, and like she mentioned, we had 41 students involved in accidents last year. They were very minor. The ones that happened most recently in Newburgh, those students were all transported to the hospital because that's what you do. You don't want to take any chances, and so you transport all the students. They were all released. There were no major injuries. I'm not saying they weren't sore. You would be if you fell, and they're bumped around and they're sore, but these are not any life-altering injuries. And the drivers injured may in fact be not school bus drivers but drivers of other vehicles. And the same with pedestrians. Last year we had a pretty severe year. We had someone under the influence actually walking down the middle of the road and was hit by the bus. It's certainly not the bus driver's fault. I would like to just show you a little example of this is a school bus about 4 years ago that was hit traveling 50 miles an hour when a car pulled out to go across the road and didn't yield to the bus driver. The picture on the outside is the damage that the bus sustained outside, and it's a pretty severe accident, but what I'd like you to look at is the seats inside. Inside the bus, this is one of the things that the location said, I can't believe it. If you were inside the bus, you wouldn't even know that it had been an accident. And I think you're going to find that with the Newburgh accident also, that you couldn't tell inside that the bus had been in an accident. Now I'm going to compare another type of vehicle. This is not a school bus. It does not meet those same federal motor vehicle safety standards. It doesn't have the roof strength. It doesn't have the joint strength. And this accident was over in the Walla Walla area. It actually was in Oregon. It was a Washington bus, though. And the kids were on this vehicle. The bus was traveling 50 miles an hour, hit by a car that didn't yield to it. Same type of accident, just from a different angle. It was from the left side rather than the right side. And I just am trying to point out to you the distortion of the seats. There were fatalities in this. The driver was killed. So you can see the difference in how the seats react and how the bus inside the integrity of it is. This is another example of a motor coach. This wasn't actually in Oregon. But again, I'm trying to show you that we don't have that roof strength in a motor coach that we do in a school bus. It's just not the same in its construction standards. Also, another big problem in our state, if you want to do something about safety, is non-conforming vans. This is not a school bus either. This vehicle has a propensity to roll over. School buses do not. If they go over, it's usually one time on its side. It doesn't continue to roll and roll and roll. Whereas a non-conforming van, a 15-passenger van, continues to roll. They come apart. They don't have that same structure. And we see a lot of schools trying to use these for activity vehicles. Here's another type of vehicle that doesn't meet school bus construction standards. Again, that may be why some of your bills want to put seat belts in this type of vehicle. They don't have a window retention. They don't have the joint strength. So if you want to improve student transportation, eliminate 15-passenger vans, get rid of pre-77 school buses, just like Representative Nelson said. Don't reduce transportation, which some of the bills over in the Education Committee are trying to reduce transportation. Transport more children and encourage youthful drivers to ride to and from school on the school bus. This is a little flyer that's distributed by the National Association of State Directors of Pupil Transportation, and I believe I provided that in a handout that just illustrates there's 25 million children that ride to and from school each day on a school bus. We have 5 passenger fatalities. These are annual figures, and 15 at bus stops, versus we have another 25 million children that get to and from school by another means, riding with a parent, riding with a sibling. And the safety record goes like this. There's 448 as teen passengers. Again, these are annual figures. 169 passengers of adult with an adult driver. 131 fatalities as pedestrians and 46 fatalities as bicyclists. So my question is, how do you want your children to go to school? And how do you want Oregon children to go to school? I thank you very much for this time to share this with you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Deborah. Questions? Yes, Ms. Amy Thatcher first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there any states now that you're aware of that mandate safety belts in school buses?
Chair Gilman, Representative Thatcher. Yes, in fact, there are. None have yet mandated lap shoulder belts. To my knowledge, New Jersey and New York mandate lap belts. They were early on in this, probably in the last 10 years. New York does not require them to use them. Neither does New Jersey. And New York does not require you to be sitting. They allow standees.
Yes.
So I suppose, so none of them have mandated lap belts, is what I hear you say. But
Representative Gillen, Chair Thatcher, yes, they have lap
belts.
That's
what I meant.
Nobody has required lap shoulder belts that I'm aware of.
Okay.
California is looking at that. I believe they sunset it. They have not, because NHTSA hasn't wrote the standards yet.
One more?
Well, actually, a couple more. Wonder if have any tests been done on just. I just know that when my children are sitting in my car, if they're short or tall, I mean, it just seems like the shoulder belts don't hit right. And I'm just wondering, has there been any testing to figure out a way to accommodate for different height children or even adults?
Representative Thatcher, I believe that's the problem. It's trying to figure out how to make a belt that's comfortable for a six-year-old to go across the collarbone and comfortable for a 16-year-old student also at the same time. And so I believe that's why there isn't a specific standard yet. They say it'll be coming.
One more.
Have any tests been done with cargo, the typical cargo that a school child would have, like backpacks and books and things like that? I'm just wondering if that needs to be something, if you're looking at restraining the child, it seems like the cargo flying around inside would also be problematic, possibly.
Chair Gilman, Representative Thatcher, that's an excellent question. That's one of the things that we try to focus on, too, is that cargo needs to be in their lap, needs to be secured safely. A lot of buses have luggage compartments underneath that they put underneath your right. I think for every pound, it's the 3 pounds of G-force that hits in an accident at times the speed. I mean, it's pretty bad. Even a Kleenex box at 3 pounds can become a missile. So you're correct. We're trying to keep everybody in the compartment, in the seat, in that area, sitting forward so that their knees impact first, followed by their chest, and they've got their things. Doesn't matter. You can't. There's no way you could ever brace in an accident. I don't know if you've ever tried that. You've got to depend on the restraint. And school buses have the passive form of restraint we call compartmentalization.
I wondered if they're in commercial buses, do they have seatbelts?
Chair Gilman, Representative Boone, commercial buses, to my knowledge, do not require seatbelts. You've driven them.
I've driven them. Senator, Chairman Gilman, Senator Boone. Depending on the manufacturer and what standards are in existence at the time, I spent 4 years driving those vehicles. I drove one that was manufactured in Belgium. They came equipped with front lap belts and the front two seats. I drove another piece of equipment that had them in the first four seats. The biggest concern there was in a frontal collision. Usually the windshield came out and whoever was sitting behind the driver went through that hole. School buses don't have those issues because a windshield is designed not to come out. The windows stay in place. As far as the rest of the passengers, there's nothing to restrain them. And my experience is 5 years ago, so I'm not sure what construction standards are looking at today.
Well, just judging by your slides here, actually the window in that one bus came right in. It probably killed the driver. And I guess I just have to comment that it seems like you spent an inordinate amount of time rationalizing, not putting in these, we saw the no restraints whatsoever in the compartmental, and I'm sorry, as an EMT, I couldn't agree with you that those people did not get hurt. I think the people in the lap belt, their necks would go too, but as you said yourself, the lap shoulder combination is the safest. They're still possibly going to get hurt. But we put so much emphasis on having people belted. That's the first question we ask people on a scene. Did you have a seatbelt on? We look for a mechanism of injury, and that's how we treat them. And if they didn't have a seatbelt, sometimes they're out of the car. And if those windows pop out and those kids go out and that bus rolls on them, then what?
Chair Gilman, Representative Boone, I'd really like to answer that question because a school bus is so much different than a passenger car. You know, a school bus sits above what we call the crash zone. A car would crash underneath the bus. The passengers would be sitting above the crash area. And the windows are not going to come out because that's the way they're designed to stay in. The window retrenching is one of the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards. So I'm not aware, I don't think you are, have come on any accidents where the windows actually came out of the bus and kids were not ejected. They stay in the bus. And you're absolutely right. I'm careful not to say that a student isn't injured because I'm sure they're sore. But the thing is, a life-altering injury. If you have that kind of neck trauma, you're more likely paralyzed if you live. And I think you probably would find it very interesting to read some of the engineering standards that was completed by NHTSA and the head trauma, the HIC count that they measure the head trauma by. And, you know, I'm not an engineer, so I just don't know those terms or numbers off the top of my head, but I'd be happy to share those with you.
Representative Byron.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, the logic of waiting until after you've actually seen testimony until you ask questions is very valuable. Because as I was looking through the reports, I was noticing tour bus crashed, you know, 15 injured, school bus, one killed, or 15 killed in a, and wondering exactly why. You know, that would be until I saw the demonstration that you were showing up there and the type of vehicle that these were. I'm not sure I'd ride in a in a bus anymore. As much as I hated those comfortable rides in the school bus, I will say, I think it'd be a little more safe. Because I know I'd heard, you know, that seatbelts didn't necessarily provide more safety in a school bus before, and so this was helpful information. As for passenger cars and seatbelts not fitting, you know, the younger kids versus taller kids, me, I, you know, I have that problem all the time, you know. I'm sure that we would not be comfortable in the same seatbelts. So I appreciate your coming, and this has answered a lot of questions for me. So thank you.
Now I'll run this side now, and then I'll be back.
Thank you, Chairman. My question is, obviously you study the crashes and you can catalog them over the years, and my question is, what is the predominant accident, and where is the predominance? Is it head-on? And I don't mean backing into a little post or doing a door scrape. I mean the real accidents. Are they head-on or are they side impact? Because as we were watching the video, it seems to me, and deference to Representative Boone because she's an expert, but from my non-expert position, it almost did look like the situation in the head-on collision, it was safer without the seatbelts versus the other two methods, certainly the lap belt. But my question is that the predominant accident, or is it the side one where you've got kids doing the rag doll through the bus as it's rolling down? And that, to me, makes a much stronger argument for the seatbelt, that side impact where the kids are flying one way or the other.
Chair Gelman, Representative Bruin. In Oregon, I could say the most predominant accident is a fixed object where the driver hit something that was parked. And I can't tell you exactly why that is, whether they get distracted. It is, in fact, backing up probably into a little post is the most common accident. And a lot of the accidents, there aren't even any students on, so I don't know who's distracting them. But regarding your question whether a frontal collision, I believe NHTSA said that the frontal collision was more predominant. I think if you look historically, the accidents that have had the most lives lost are train bus crashes, and it doesn't matter where you're sitting. If you're in the impact, it doesn't matter where you're sitting. If you're in the impact zone, whether you're belted or not, you're not going to survive it. Or a crash with a very large semi-truck, snowplow, something of equal size. But if it's car versus bus, the bus is winning.
Yeah, certainly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A little different line. If there were no cost to this, if there were absolutely no cost to implementing that, if it just you had to push a button and it were done, as somebody who's studied this and talked with experts, what's safer, the seatbelts with the shoulder harness or no seatbelts at all? Forgetting about cost. Perfect world.
I just have to, Representative or Chair Gelman, Representative Bruin, I think in a perfect world, I think NHTSA said if a lap shoulder belt, if you could guarantee that they always wore it correctly 100% of the time. And I think that's their concern, and that's why they haven't come up with a standard yet. They're very concerned about writing standards for that, and then having other issues come up because students were injured. That's the best I can answer that. I did want to mention one accident that we had two legislative sessions ago. Sweet Home had an accident over on Highway 99, and it was hit by a truck, a semi-milk truck. And that truck driver actually crossed the center lane and started into the school bus driver's lane of travel. Because of her expertise, she knew what was happening. She went to the right like she was supposed to, got herself off the road as much as possible. It hit the driver and then down the side of the bus. And there was an injury in that one. The coach that was sitting behind the driver had a broken shoulder. But again, you know, those are the most serious accidents we've had in Oregon.
Representative
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson earlier talked about the the safety division between 377 and 477 buses. I assume all the graphic that showed all the requirements is the 477, or even maybe more recent. Could you talk about what types of buses we have out there? How many 377? How many that don't meet the standard do we have out there in terms of Oregon School District today?
Chair Gilman, Representative Hunt, there was a division. In 1977, NHTSA started to regulate school buses, and that's when they instigated all of the federal motor vehicle safety standards. So prior, any school bus manufactured prior to 1977 does not meet these safety. They don't have the compartmentalization. They don't have the joint strength. They don't have the roof, the window retention, and I think we have 23 left in Oregon at this time.
23.
I mean, that seems, I realize we're in the middle of all this disagreement about whether or not safety belts are viable or not. It seems like that would be a place of clear consensus of let's get rid of those 23 buses. And I wonder, I mean,
would you like to amend your bill?
Is there, I mean, is there any, I see Representative Nelson nodding vociferously on this point. Is there any other effort underway to get rid of those immediately? Or
Chair Gilman, Representative Hunt, no. It has come up in other legislative sessions. There are districts that still have pre-77 buses that this would be an extreme hardship for them to replace them. We have some in Eastern Oregon that have a fleet that's majority of pre-77 school buses. I can also tell you exactly where they're at if you'd like to know. I don't know if you want that.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I would be interested in that, and also a sense of what the replacement cost of those would be.
I think that Stephen Hewlett can answer the replacement costs.
Chair Gillum and Representative Hunt, for the size of buses that they're using in that district that we're talking about, they're 78 to 84 passenger, and the price of the new school bus coming in right now that I've been doing has been around between $85,000 and $88,000 to replace those buses each.
And would you state your name, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. Stephen Hewlett, for the record.
That's fine. This is 22 buses out of how many buses have we got running around the state?
Representative Gillum, we have about 6,000. That includes activity buses. That includes what we call Type 10. They're like Suburbans that they may use in smaller locations or difficult to access. Some special ed use that.
Thank you. Now we'll go back to this item. I think it's
I was going to say there is, at least we have it in our pickup truck. The shoulder piece, there's an adjustment of about 8 inches that you could, for short people, would help.
Well, I do have an adjustment on mine, but it's still, I'm short.
Okay, representing part.
What is the market? I mean, how often does a district replace a bus and say, if someone was interested in buying a newer bus that was being replaced, what kind of a market value, I suppose? I mean, obviously it depends on the year, but does that happen a lot? Would a district like that have to buy new buses, or would there be available used buses out there for them?
Chair Gillum, Representative Beyer. Currently, if they're going to purchase a school bus, it has to meet the current minimum standards, which is 2005. They would have to buy a bus that meets that standards. What would be the reasoning of increasing standards if you didn't enforce them? So they have increased fire safety, the number of emergency exits that you would have per seating place. So, yes, the standards have been upgraded since 1977. So, you know, a district would need to buy a bus that met current standards. The statute says that if you buy a school bus, then we will reimburse, the Department of Ed reimburses you 10% of that purchase price over 10 years, and that was supposed to be put in a special fund that is accounted for separately so that when it was time to buy a new bus, you would have the money, in fact, there to purchase a new school bus. And a new school bus cost between $70,000 and $84,000, depending on the specification, the seating, the transmission. There are no Cadillac buses. There are three major makers of school buses, and they all come in yellow.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. You've been very helpful and informative.
Can I just say something in closing? I just really want to applaud Representative Nelson's trying to do something for safety for kids. Of course, it's our passion, and we would be very happy to work with her on any other type of increased safety measure and work with the committee on education, too, so that we can keep transportation for students. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Can I just ask one last question?
Certainly.
How can we, if we're trying to teach our children good preventive health care, life choices, all that, how can we justify to them and try to say, when you get in the car, every time part of getting in the car is buckling up, but then when they're in their school bus, they don't have to? How do you rationalize that with the child?
Chair Gilman, Representative Bloom, that's an excellent question, and that is one argument that's really valid. And I've frequently spoke to children about the differences between a school bus and a car, and how important it is that they wear their seatbelt in their car, and try to explain to them the difference of a school bus. And in that same time, I pull into it how important it is that they're sitting bottom to bottom, back to back on the seat. So it isn't that we're ignoring safety, it's just a different kind of safety. And again, we always emphasize in closing, but in your car, you always wear your seatbelt.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
Anyone else to testify on 2502? Close the public hearing on 2502. And members or John, do we have anything else?
Just briefly, Mr. Chair, if I might, to let all of you know, the first meeting of the work group dealing with the school speed zone bills is tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock in room 446, which is in the old part of the Capitol building on the fourth floor at that end of the hall. You're all welcome to drop by if you'd like. Just remember that we can't end up with a quorum in the room at any particular time because we haven't noticed it as a public meeting.
Anything else? Here's the curtain.